Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Sorry for that slight delay for us getting going. We're having one or two technical issues. I guess when you come from the global south, from the other side, who knows what the technology is going to be like here. Good morning. My name's Roger Skultz, and this is the third session of the series that I've been presenting, entitled Seeing the Word. And so what I thought I would do this morning, just as we get going, is very, very briefly, and I really will try to do this in, you know, maybe just a few minutes, is to quickly just recap where we've been over the sessions thus far. Because I think that would be helpful in citing us for what we're going to be doing this morning. And so in the first session at the start of this week, we looked at the flood narrative in the book of Genesis and suggested that there can be different frames. I'm sorry, this microphone is just kind of coming and going. We'll try not to let that be a distraction. I suggested there could be different frames in which the flood narrative in Genesis can be read. The traditional frame is used would be to see the flood narrative as a story of judgment. It's a story about consequences of sin, and indeed the punishment thereof. And the picture of God that emerges within that frame is God, in a sense, somewhat angry, maybe vengeful, and certainly there's much which is problematic in terms of that picture, in terms of the violence of God that seems to be presented. Within that particular frame, that traditional frame of judgment, there is a deconstructive reading. Deconstructive readings are readings that read against the grain of the text, that they look at the surface meaning of the text, that try to penetrate deeper, and to see, in a sense, a reading that goes against the grain of the text. And a deconstructive reading within this frame of judgment of the flood narrative would actually see the text as a renunciation of violence. That taking this well-established motif within the ancient Near East of a flood narrative, that the text actually deconstructs that particular motif. And it happens in the forging of covenant at the end of the flood narrative. And as God sets God's bow in the heavens, the bow, a symbol of a weapon, it's like God is hanging up his bow. It's like a boxer hanging up his gloves, saying that no longer will the methodology of violence be the way to deal with the brokenness within the world. So that would be a deconstructive reading, but it's still within this frame of judgment. But we suggested that there are other frames that can be used. We looked at the frame of the suffering, sorrowing parent. And we used this image by Gustave Doré of the Deluge, which depicts parents, both human and non-human, in the midst of the calamity of the deluge, motivated by the desire in terms of saving and rescuing their young. And we suggested that within Doré's imagination, he's giving us an insight perhaps to something of what is going on in the heart of God. And that as God is grieved for what had happened in terms of humanity, It's the frame of the suffering, sorrowing parents that maybe can show and shine a different light upon the text. We then looked at the frame of deliverance. And again, this would be in accordance with what is commonly understood in terms of the flood narrative, and particularly the place of the ark as this instrument in which Noah is invited into partnership with God through his work of construction of the ark, that the ark becomes this vehicle of deliverance for Noah and his family, and indeed for all life on earth. And we looked briefly at the Moses story, where in the Hebrew scriptures, the same word for the ark in the Genesis narrative is used of the basket that preserves Moses, Teva. And so that image, the image of the ark, or Dore's image of the rock, becomes an image of deliverance, and that could be another frame for understanding the flood narrative. What is God's work of deliverance in the face of chaos, of calamity, of the kind of like the unraveling of God's creative purposes, the impetus within the divine to deliver. And then we also looked at the frame of baptism. I was saying, how might the flood narrative be understood in terms of the categories of baptism, which of course chart the journey of death and resurrection? And indeed, recreation. And so this particular image, again, of Dore, in terms of the dove being sent from the ark, but the landscape of death, which hasn't yet been wiped clean, it's part of the reality of what this moment represents. It's acknowledging the reality of death, but death and resurrection. And even as the Spirit was hovering over the chaos of the waters in creation in Genesis 1-2, so as this dove is sent, maybe it's a symbol of the Spirit. And that verse in Psalm 104, verse 30, when you send forth your Spirit, they are created, and you shall renew the face of the earth. So that was what we looked at in the first session on Monday. In the second session, we looked at, amongst other things, at some chaos traditions in the Hebrew scriptures, the category of chaos in biblical studies referring to those forces or entities or beings or systems that are anti-creational. And some chaos traditions that can be discerned within the Hebrew scriptures, the oldest of which resonates with the picture of chaos that is established within the thought world of the ancient Near East, is of chaos as a personified opponent of God and of God's ordered creation. We said that within this paradigm, within this tradition of chaos, God is always victorious. Whenever there's the sense of this battle motif between God and these personified forces of chaos, God always emerges victorious within the Hebrew tradition, within the Hebrew scriptures. But the victory that God achieves is strategic, not absolute. It doesn't result in the obliteration of the forces of chaos forever. And so there's a sense in which what is required is a divine vigilance in terms of containing the forces of chaos, lest they break forth again and threaten to undo God's created order. A second chaos tradition in the Hebrew scriptures refers to chaos as a non-oppositional elemental entity. And Genesis 1 would be the key text in this regard, in which there's no vestige of any sense of conflict in terms of God's creation. That chaos, the tohu vabohu, the formless void, is out of this God orders the created order. And then we looked at chaos as the agent or instrument of God. The flood narrative would be one example, the plagues in Exodus, the Jonah story would be another, in which God seems to use these symbols of the watery chaos and enlists these within God's purposes of recreation or of deliverance or whatever it may be. And then finally, we looked at chaos as part of the risky design of God's creation, and particularly the ways in which Behemoth and Leviathan are depicted in the book of Job. And the somewhat disturbing idea that, uh, that what we would regard as chaotic and what has traditionally been understood as antagonistic towards God, that the divine imagination in fact stretches much broader and wider. And that within the divine imagination, even those forces and those entities that traditionally have been understood as antithetical to creation and God's ordered creation, in fact, are separated by the divine. And so with that very brief recap, I don't know if there's any questions or comments. And I know that I've just gone sort of whistling through that very quickly because I do want to obviously get to the material for today. But are there any questions or comments about any of that, just in terms of locating what we'll be looking at today in where we've come over the sessions thus far? Trusting it's all as clear as mud. Any questions or observations? And if not, that's fine because we're going to move on. But I want to just check. Everybody okay? All right. Great. So as we kind of transition today, I'd like to begin. Oh, sorry. Very, very important. Gee whiz. Last little line at the bottom of the Chaos Traditions, but crucial for today. That the signifiers of chaos within the Hebrew Scriptures especially, the symbols that point to this are varied. And they would include the sea, the waves, the waters, the floods, sea monsters, and then sometimes they actually have personified names, Leviathan, Rahab, Lotan, Tanin. But the idea of the sea, the waters, the waves, are the signifiers of these forces of chaos, and especially stormy seas, where there's a sense in which something is being roused. And so a stormy sea is a key image within the mythological thought world of the ancient Hebrews, conveying the sense of the entities of chaos that stand over against the ordering of God's creation. Okay, as we transition into what we could be looking at today, I would like to invite you when I say the phrase the other side. What comes to mind for you? Who or what is on the other side? I'm keeping it intentionally very broad. And as we think a little bit about what all's been happening this week, you know, what Jason has been presenting on immigration and race and LGBT and the planetary crisis and what Ace has been presenting in terms of the beloved community. And as we think about all of this, as you think about your particular context, your life right now, and I'm going to say to you the phrase, the other side. What comes to mind for you? Who or what is on the other side? I wonder if you could maybe just find a partner, perhaps in huddles of two or three. And if you could just buzz amongst yourselves, and I'd like us to brainstorm together different responses to that simple question.
Immediately I think of the other side of the coin. You know, it's out of place. One's heads, one's tails. The dark side of those kinds of things. Something different than this side.
Whatever the side is.
Yeah. So, different scrubbing, or just difference by construction.
The other side of the skin.
Yeah.
Well, I think what initially comes to mind is what's on the other side of this life.
Oh.
You know, what's next more than others.
Yeah.
Oh.
But then again, you know, and that's the kingdom of God is on the other side. But no, the kingdom of God is actually on this side as much as we practice it and image it.
Yeah.
Oftentimes I think of other side as, I guess if you use the dark side and opposition.
Yeah, the other side of the debate, the other side of the question. And you can't describe this side without forbidding it.
Yeah.
I mean, the two things go hand in hand, even if they're contentious.
Yeah. We almost have to have that. You know, otherwise we just totally one dimensional.
Yeah.
Take it for understand day in terms of night.
Mm-hmm.
And we understand
good from
bad. And would we have to invent another side if everything was all good?
Mm-hmm.
You know, could we understand something in and of itself without comparison?
Okay, if I could interrupt those conversations and let's hear. So I'd like us just to brainstorm a bit together in terms. Sorry, was there a question? No. I'd like us just to brainstorm together in terms of some of the different possibilities of who or what might be on the other side, how you make sense of that phrase. So who'd like to kick us off? Yes.
I'd like a little clearer definition of the other side. I mean, are we talking about if I'm a Democrat, the Republicans are on the other side?
Right. So, okay. So, well, you name it. So Republicans, say.
Yeah.
I'm intentionally keeping it quite sort of broad, because I'd like to see what kind of is elicited. But what you've identified in terms of the political sort of political spectrum, you have particular convictions. Those on the other side may well be of a different party. They may well be Democrats on the other side for some who are here. So, but I'm going to just honor what you've named.
Well,
thank you.
Everything you said is kind of like our view of what's happening.
Right.
To me, the other side is God's view.
Aha. Okay. So God's view.
I saw the other side as the future.
Okay. Tell us more about what you mean by that.
Well, we're here, and the other side is where we're going.
And are you thinking in terms of like the whole idea of like the afterlife? Is it that kind of sense?
In terms of the beloved community, in terms of what solving the whites, answering the white supremacy issues. What is the future?
So maybe, okay, thank you. So the future, so you're kind of talking about, if I'm hearing you, almost like this vision of an alternative, that maybe it's a hopeful vision.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the future, the eschatological kingdom of God, but it's kind of where we think of where we are now. This is definitely like on the other side. Okay, thank you. That's great. Yes, over here we'll come to the side again in a moment.
One of the dichotomies that emerged in the discussions this week were characterizing Christianity as a group of people that emphasize personal salvation versus a group of people who are more interested in social justice.
Right.
And
right.
The more fundamentalist versus the more progressive,
right,
Christianity.
So if you were to name it for yourself, if you were to, and again, I don't want to put you on the spot in terms of maybe identifying where on that spectrum you'd find yourself, who would the other side be for you?
The personal salvation would be the other side.
Right. So the whole kind of
fundamentalist
personal salvation, understanding of faith, slash fundamentalism, maybe that's perhaps not the best word, But you would see that as an understanding of faith. It's kind of on the other side from where you are. Okay, thank you. That's great. Let's keep it going. Yes.
I guess it's hope that we will transition through this chaos and something. I have no idea what will be there.
Right, so it's touching on this sort of idea of like the future. Maybe we can kind of put in there sort of the hope, you know, the hope for future. You would see that as being on the other side. Yes, Bill?
We were thinking of the other side as an opposite, as that which we use to understand what we have, as in light versus, we understand light when we see dark. It was a comparison type of thing. We understand good, and when we see evil, we understand so injustice versus against justice. Yeah, it was the comparison that helps us understand what we have in front of us right now.
Right. Okay. So you kind of,
more generic.
Okay. So you're kind of talking about something like almost maybe like the binary sort of opposites.
That's it.
And okay, so that's like perhaps just like a general comment. If you were to kind of give content to that, and I'm looking quite specifically here, you know, in terms of who, what, are there groups of people, are there particular sort of points of view, ideologies that might represent those on the other side? Yes.
This might go along with his, but it's from Jason Mann's talking of the other side of white privilege.
Right.
The people who drive while black. Being black, you know.
Right, so you would say from a perspective of white privilege, those on the other side would be black folks.
Right, who don't walk with confidence.
Right, so can we just, you know, put that down as bluntly as that, within that context of white privilege, those on the other side would be black people.
But it also could be immigrants. It could be
right. Okay, so let's end that.
Or it could be economic things as well.
The other side is what's outside.
Okay, let's keep it going. So,
NRA.
So yes.
The NRA.
The NRA.
Right.
Yes.
The Confederate battle flag and everything it stands for.
Right. Yes.
Well, if what we're looking at is the goal is to achieve something like saving the planet.
Right.
Then. And talking about the other side, it's easy to find a scapegoat. And I would have to say, well, I'm on the other side, because I do my share to screw up the planet. And so I guess it's a function of deciding just what does other side mean? Does it?
And that's what I'm wanting us to think about. So let's just stay with that for a moment. So in the context of the whole sort of planetary crisis, and the recognition of our complicity in that, in systems that are actually profoundly damaging the Earth, what would the other side be for us who recognize that place? Could it be, you know, and it could be plenty of possibilities, but for example, a simplified lifestyle, you know, very simple, you know, living...
Basic life.
Living sort of like the simple life that's not defined by consumerism. I mean, would that be, you know, does that works for you? So can I just put that down?
The other side would be something good in that context.
Right, right. So so the simple life, and what that might. You know, okay, yeah, some other suggestions, the other side. What about the whole conversation around LGBT, the whole LGBT conversation? To what extent, what might the other side be within that conversation?
Acceptance?
Again, I'm trying to ask, like, who or what is, you know, so when you say acceptance, just help me to understand what you're understanding
by
that.
Well, a broad spectrum of sexuality.
Right.
That's okay.
So you're saying the other side would, from maybe a perspective of sort of like a very narrow and, you know, dare I say it, perhaps the bigoted perspective, the other side would be a place of far greater acceptance and inclusivity. So, okay, thank you. So, and I'm going to just put you at LGBTQ. One or two more?
I was thinking that, depending on how things go, maybe we white folk are going to be, there will not be white people. There will be mixed brown.
Right.
Broad spectrum of color.
And so, in terms of the phrase "the other side," for as a, we've named that already in terms of the racial thing, but you're kind of talking a little bit about
on this side, we're talking about separation, black, white.
Right.
And I'm saying maybe we'll all be one.
Right. So and maybe it connects with this idea of the future and the hope that you're kind of talking about, a kind of like a far greater sort of integrated society, eh? Would that maybe capture it a little? One or two more, and anybody that I'm missing up top, the other side. What about in terms of the whole area of economics? We've touched on that a little in terms of the planetary thing, the simple life. But what might the other side be in terms of economics?
The 1%.
Okay.
The homeless and the hungry.
Referring to the uber wealthy, but I'm hearing somebody else saying?
The homeless and the hungry.
The homeless, the hungry and the poor. I mean, let's just name it. We all come from places of immense economic privilege. The very fact that we can be here just speaks of that. That you can actually take time out for leisure in a place like this, all of us. So that's a reality in terms of where we come from. So the other side on that particular axis is referring to people for whom, you know, the privilege, the luxury of a space like this is like a dream. Any others? Okay, so we're going to just leave this list up with us, and we're going to turn to a text, and it'll be up on the screen. There are Bibles, if sometimes people prefer to actually have a text in front of them, so feel free to help yourself. But we're going to be having a look at this text, and today I know that this, you know, some of the sessions before have been fairly sort of dense. I'm hoping just to slow things down a little today as we journey through this text. Would anybody be happy to read it, even just off the screen or from the text, if you've got it in front of you? And who would be happy to do so?
On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd behind, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was. Other boats were with him. A great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that the boat was already being swamped. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion, and they woke him up and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" He woke up and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." Then the wind ceased, and there was a dead calm. He said to them, "Why are you afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great awe and said to one another, "Who then is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him?"
Thank you very much. And so the particular artwork that I'd like us to spend a little bit of time with this morning, and again, it's out of the opus of Gustave Doré, and would be this particular image that is prompted by this text. And for those of you who have the actual hard copy handouts, it's on the very back page of that. And so I'd like us just to take a few moments to look at this image. And what is it that you notice about it?
Chaos.
And so it's before we start charting out, Bill, thank you, we're going to have a chance to do that in a moment. If we can just take a few more moments in terms of what do you notice? Is there anything that particularly draws you? Does anything strike you as unusual?
It's a very crowded boat.
Right, so let's hear. Sorry, so Chuck,
it feels like a very crowded boat.
It's a crowded boat.
I think of some of the immigrants coming across, or they from Cuba, back in Cuba.
Right, so there's a resonance for you in terms of those overcrowded boats, in terms of Syrian refugees or those from Cuba, okay? You were saying, Bill?
Chaos, because we have the waves breaking over and everybody looks like they may be flailing about or trying to do something, trying to bail, but it's anything but it's total confusion.
Okay.
Chaos is an oppositional force.
Okay. Thank you. Elaine?
And if we can't tell who's calm, it's got a little halo floating above.
Right. Okay. So you're noticing that that the person of Jesus is given this little halo. Okay. So it's a pointer.
Van Gogh did this.
Yes. What else do you see?
There's a line of division. The Jesus side is just one.
Right.
Almost a line with all the group.
Right. So there's a sense that within even this crowded boat, there's the other side, even within this boat. Thank you. That's great. Yes.
They're sailing into darkness.
Right.
Clearly into, away from the light, the light from the picture in the front, but
right.
It's all dark in the end.
So you're kind of seeing the kind of the contrast between light from where it's come to the inky darkness over to where they're going. Great, thank you. What else do you notice and see? Yes, Jason.
The prow of this boat looks an awful lot like the prow of the ark and I don't know what you call it, of the bassinet that most of the boats.
Sorry, I didn't quite. It looks a lot like the.
So the prow of this boat.
Uh huh.
Not like the prow of the ark that we saw earlier.
Ah.
Of the basket.
Okay. So you're seeing a kind of like a visual connection.
He has this similar curve.
Right. Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you. What else do you see? Yes.
My first reaction was the halo, but I thought, wouldn't it be nice if you could look and see the good guys because there was a halo?
like a nifty feature, hey?
Yeah, in real life, it would be really nice.
Right. Over here and then over there.
I'm looking at the man across from Jesus who's just sitting there with his arms on the side of the boat. He does not look like he's in terror.
Right, so this guy over here, you think he's kind of... He's looking kind of nonchalant to you, hey? Okay, interesting. How does that contrast with maybe some others of the disciples in the boat? Well, we'll come back to that, but there was a hand over here, then I'll come into this side.
Well, I sort of imagine Jesus there just waking up from being asleep in the stern of the boat.
Uh-huh.
As the chaos is going on all around him, and he's just sort of looking around and saying, okay, what's the problem here?
Okay.
And they're all in a panic.
So you're seeing the difference between the kind of the calm of Christ and the kind of the chaos and the panic of the disciples. Thank you. Yes.
I see a rudderless, overloaded boat with no means of locomotion, and my first reaction is they're no wonder they're swamping out there.
Right.
They have no clue how to handle a boat, apparently. I don't know.
Okay, okay. A rudderless boat, kind of at the mercy. At the mercy. Yes, up top there.
I was just noticing the birds up there, that they don't seem to be in chaos. They're all just floating freely up there.
Right.
They're not afraid of
someone. Right. You remember the image of the deluge we looked at in the first, for those of you who are here, the rock, and again there were birds in the air. And the Moses image, the Dore Moses image, with again like angels sort of hovering. And so you're seeing the birds kind of seem to be, hey, this is like okay, it's like all right. Yes, Asa.
I know we said that they look like they're going into darkness, but looking at it for a period of time, they also could be coming out of darkness.
Uh-huh.
So you're not really sure which direction they're going.
Right.
But it appears that the light is, you know, on the side of Christ.
Right.
But gives the impression that it could be going or coming.
Right. Except that that's such an interesting comment, thank you. And so that sort of sense of, you know, it looks like we're heading into the darkness, but are we? The text, of course, refers to Christ being asleep in the stern, which is the back of the boat. And so it would suggest that, you know, the earlier comment is that, but thank you very much. It's kind of like there's this sort of little sense of uncertainty.
Yeah, being in the back of the boat doesn't mean that you're going
forward. Aha, 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 okay, okay, okay. And especially when it's kind of like all going around. What do you think of this, I haven't got my point here, but what do you think of this sort of, you know, the waves that are kind of sort of crashing in on the sort of left side? Is that reminiscent of any images for you?
Looks like a parting of the Red Sea.
Right, me. Right. So the sense in which the seas, the walls of the sea, it's kind of like, except that the sea hasn't actually parted, but maybe there's just, maybe there's an association that's kind of conveyed there. Chuck?
You also have a sense to what Ace was saying, a sense of tension with the wave that's kind of on the left-hand side that looks a little bit calmer on the right. There's tension between the darkness and the light, not sure which way they're going. So there's something about, for me, holding tension in the midst of that.
Right. And if I can just perhaps pause on that point, and it was a comment that was made earlier, is that as we look at this boat, this crowded boat, it would seem to me one of the compelling things about this image that gets hold of me, is that it seems like this boat has kind of two parts to it. With Christ on one side and this mob of disciples on the other. And I'm intrigued by the space between them. I'd like us to come back to that a little. And what might that space be saying? And then do you notice that there are stars in the sky? Can you see there's some stars breaking through? What is, you know? And again, the Dore image of the deluge, there were stars that were breaking through. In a sense that whatever storm is happening, there's the light beyond that's kind of penetrating. Okay. This was just like a little bit more of a closer view. And so, do you notice, well, how many disciples are in this boat?
There should be 12.
How many are there? I should actually have my pointer for this, but as you have a look and see, how many disciples can you count?
10.
Okay. Any offers?
Five.
Look a little bit closer. Okay, so let's. I've had the opportunity of looking at this a bit more closely, all right? So, and I appreciate it. So let's count them. So we've got, we would agree that there's the chap with his arms, there's one, there's two, there's three, there is four, there's five. All happy with that so far?
Yeah.
Here is six, there is seven, there is eight, there is nine, there is ten, and if you look carefully, there is 11. 11 disciples in the boat. How many disciples? There should be
12.
There should be 12. There should be 12. So we're down one disciple. We're down one disciple. Again, I mean, is this kind of coincidental? Is this part of Doré's genius? If we down one disciple, the question is, well, where's that disciple? Or is the question that there's in fact space for one more disciple?
Yeah.
And who is that going to be?
It'd be Judas. It'd be Judas. Or it could be any of them, actually.
Could be us. As we're looking at this image,
right,
there's the sense in which there's space within it for another disciple to enter. Yeah. And so, what does that mean in terms of the invitation to be a part of what's going on here? And where is the space for another disciple to enter, to find a spot in this crowded boat?
Right by Jesus.
Which is the space between Christ and the rest of the disciples. We're going to return to that a little bit later. Yes.
And it's a scary invitation.
Ha.
Because look what we are volunteering to enter into.
Right. So with those comments, we're going to come back to this image. I'd like us to...
Roger?
Yes?
On that image, we've got a small circle of disciples looking at Jesus, but then one, two, three, four, but then we also have four waves coming back. Uh-huh. And the disciples are looking at Jesus, and the waves are coming back, so we see an oppositional force with Jesus right in the center.
Okay, thank you. And another comment that maybe does need to be made. Can you see these disciples here? What is being done? What is the gesture? Where's the movement of those disciples in this moment?
One in the middle is going forward. And the other two are holding him back?
Well, so is it not a case that they are all kind of holding back? That they're kind of, that there's like this retreating. There's this kind of like, whoa! There's this sense of, oh my word. Look at this disciple kind of turning away. These disciples kind of holding one another back. That there's something about this Jesus in this moment that is causing a deep anxiety. We're going to come to that in the text in a moment. But just hold that thought. Okay, so we'll keep this image before us. But I'd like us to walk through this text on which this image, you know, that inspires this image. And so it begins, Mark 4, verse 35. On that day, Let's stop there, on that day. Well, so what's that referring to? Well, on one hand, it could be referring quite literally to, well, on that day, as Jesus and his disciples were doing this thing, on that day, this event happened. And if we read the context of Mark 4, what happens, what we find immediately prior to this over the course of chapter 4 would be parables that Jesus talks and tells about the sower, about the growing seed, about the mustard seed. Parables about seed being scattered, seed being sown, and seed that grows, often in exponential ways, in prolific and abundant ways, in mysterious ways, in ways that, like a mustard seed, being the smallest of the seeds, is able to give shelter to all of the birds of the air. That was what Jesus had been teaching about on that day. And so on that day, with that teaching, in a sense, in the background, the story unfolds. That could be one way in which we read that. But the phrase "on that day" can also have other associations, particularly eschatological associations. You recall that when we looked at Isaiah 27 verse 1, we were talking about Leviathan. We read in Isaiah 27 verse 1, "On that day, the Lord with his cruel and great and powerful sword." And so that phrase, "on that day," points to some eschatological moment. And so could it be that Mark is indicating that what's happening here is that there's like something eschatological like in the mix? So two ways in which, even as the story unfolds in the very first words, like, well, is it the sense of these parables of seed and sowing and the kingdom that comes in mysterious ways, that bursts forth, that can't be contained? The sense of what's coming on that day. On that day when evening had come. So what associations would you be having with that, when evening had come?
Getting dark.
Getting dark. And what does that mean? When it gets dark.
Scary.
Rest. Interesting. In fact, that thought connects with, so yes, the idea of darkness and the kind of the foreboding of that, but the thought of rest connects, of course, with the Hebrew understanding that day began at sundown. Then there was evening, and then there was morning, the first day, the second day, the third day. The idea that the day begins with rest. Or the idea that there's a new day that is beginning. So when evening had come, a new day, in a sense, is unfolding. Is this a story about that new day? This eschatological hope of what the kingdom is going to bring. Connecting with the teachings of seed that gets sown and the abundance that unfolds. Something new is being birthed. On that day when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." So, again, quite literally, what would that have been a reference to for Jesus and for his disciples? Going across to the other side, and this is a key sort of motif in Mark's gospel in terms of the sea crossings, going back and forth. But what was on the other side? The Gentiles. And what would that have represented for good, God-fearing, respectful Jews?
No-go.
A no-go zone. No self-respecting Jew would willingly head off into Gentile territory. It's kind of like not kosher. And Jesus says, let us go across to the other side. Think for just a moment what those words, how those words would have resonated within the disciples. What would have been their response as he says to them, let's go across, it's getting dark. Evening has come. It's like, the day is done. Yes, we know that everything about a new day, but like, you know, like, practically speaking, the day is done. You know, there's been teaching. It's like, hey. Now he says, let's go across to the other side. What do you think would have been the feeling within them? No. What?
No.
No.
Hell no.
In fact, when there's another crossing to the other side, a little later in Mark in chapter 6, we read that Jesus, on that occasion, Jesus made them get into the boat. And so there's a kind of a, like a resistance, there's a reluctance to go to the other side. And as we hear that phrase in terms of Gentiles, let's just remember this is some of what we've populated this flip chart with in terms of what it might mean to be going to the other side and the risk and the threat of that. Leaving the crowd behind. Any thoughts? Yes.
Before we get to that.
Yes, yes, thank you.
You mentioned the previous parables have been about planting the seeds.
Right.
So going across and planting the seeds of hope, faith, whatever, with the Gentiles. So if that's the crossing.
Exactly. This is part of Jesus' endeavor in terms of, well, where might seed be planted? What is the scope and the extent? Where are the boundaries for this kingdom? Are the boundary lines just, well, amongst good folk like us? Or is there, does the sower not spread the seed, like, with reckless abandon? Not just in the good soil, but on the path. I mean, that's the point of the story, really, in terms of this recklessness with which this is sown. So thank you very, very much. So leaving the crowd behind, any sort of thoughts in terms of what that might be, kind of any sort of responses to that?
Well, Jesus would leave the crowd behind to go to a solitary place to pray. So now this, well, leaving the crowd behind, well, everybody left the crowd behind, which would say, oh, their first thought would be, oh, they're going to a place of quiet and rest and peace where they could pray.
Well, so you're correct in terms of Jesus turning aside, but this text is actually talking about something very different. This is not a place of peace and quiet and rest where they can pray. This is the other side, which is Gentile country. And so there's nothing kind of restful. This is not a bit of R&R. This is not Lady of the Lake kind of stuff. You know, hey, we're heading up to Holden. No. This is going elsewhere. So leaving the crowd behind. Well, just a little earlier in Mark in chapter 3, this is from verse 7. We read, Jesus departed with his disciples to the sea, and a great multitude from Galilee followed him. Hearing all that he was doing, they came to him in great numbers from all over. And then verse 9, he told his disciples to have a boat ready for him because of the crowd, so that they would not crush him. For he had cured many, so that all who had diseases pressed upon him to touch him. I mean, it's so understandable. It's so natural. Here's Jesus. He's performing these incredible miracles. And so he's drawing this incredible gathering, this incredible crowd, which of course makes sense. I mean, who wouldn't want to kind of come and touch Jesus? It's like, hey, there's kind of like free healthcare on offer here. Hey? there's like huge benefit in terms of coming to hang out with Jesus. It's like he's going to fix your brokenness. And we see within, particularly the first half of Mark's gospel, as the great works of power and the workings of miracles are happening, there's a sense in which, yeah, hey, this is a Jesus that we like to kind of get with. And just as a little sort of aside, at the sort of the junction point, the midway point in the gospel, where Jesus says to the disciples, "Well, who do you say that I am?" And Jesus and Peter replies in Mark's gospel, "You are the Christ." And that becomes the moment when Jesus then starts talking about his suffering and his death. And Peter would have none of it. We like the butt-kicking Jesus, you know, the Chuck Norris Jesus, who kind of, you know, like wheels and deals and sorts things out. We don't want a Jesus where there's going to be cost. And so he tells the disciples to have a boat ready for him because of the crowd, so that they would not crush him. Is that a reference not just to kind of the physical, sort of literal, sort of pressing in of crowd, but in terms of the feed me Jesus, heal me Jesus, what have you got to do for me Jesus, would not crush him, in terms of what the bigger picture of this mission of his was about. And the crowd who will follow, of course, when there's a free lunch. But he leaves the crowd behind. And he says to his disciples, "We're going across to the other side." And so they took him with them in the boat, just as he was. That's a great line. I mean, is there any other way of taking Jesus? Mm-hmm. We often try, of course. But just as he was, they took him with them in the boat. And then this curious little sort of half a verse in 36, other boats were with him. Don't you ever sort of thought about that? And what do you think that connection might be? He's left the crowds behind. The disciples are with him in the boat. And we have this reference, other boats were with him.
And it says other boats were with him, not just other boats were there.
Right. Thank you. That strengthens it even more. Other boats were with him. And we don't hear about these other boats again. Just this little line. Maybe as we think about what it means to be the disciples of Jesus, of being invited into the boats to go on these journeys, in terms of the hope, this eschatological hope of what this kingdom is going to bring, and to be going to the other side, that we are reminded that in fact there are others that are making this journey. That it's not only those who are named as disciples of Jesus who are actually part of the mission of Jesus. And there's for me hope in that. But also challenge. It's a phrase that we can ponder a little more. And so, in a sense, with it all being set up, we now come to the crux of the story. Verse 37, a great windstorm arose and the waves beat into the boat so that the boat was already being swamped. Now, I want to just make a point here, and again, in light of the chaos traditions from the Hebrew tradition, a great windstorm arose and the waves beat into the boat so that the boat was already being swamped. It would seem that the boat, this vehicle of getting to the other side, is in a sense the target of the storm. Jason, you made a wonderful observation about the image and the connection with both the prow of the ark and the basket of Moses. But there's a sense in which there's a significant distinction here in terms of this boat and the ark, the teva of the ark and of Moses' basket. That the ark and of Moses' basket, in a sense, were places of sanctuary through the chaos, the watery chaos of the flood, or what the waters of the Nile represented as a place of death of the Hebrew boys. The Tevah that of the ark and of Moses' basket was like this place of sanctuary. But this boat is a boat that's going somewhere to the other side. And it's almost as if it's kind of in the crosshairs of the storm. The waves beat into the boat. So the boat was already being swamped. There's the sense in which, as Jesus is inviting his disciples to be going on this journey, it's almost like the forces opposed to the new creation of God are kind of mustering their strength. We've kind of got that sort of oppositional motif of the forces of chaos at work here that are kind of now pressing against this endeavor, this missionary endeavor to go to the other side. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And let's just pause there. So can you think of another story of a great storm and somebody asleep in the cushion, asleep in the boat? What story comes to mind from the Hebrew scriptures?
Well, Jonah, but he's down with the baggage.
Jonah, there we go. Great storm and Jonah asleep. So there's a kind of a resonance with the Jonah story here. Except again, there's a strong distinction. What was Jonah doing? He had been sent to the other side, to Nineveh. This was enemy country. To go and proclaim God's judgment, which in fact Jonah knew. Jonah knew that to proclaim God's judgment meant that he would be drawing the enemies under the ark of God's, under the ark of the holy, and that the judgment of God is always laced with mercy. And so his resistance to that call was precisely because the judgment of God would be for the purpose of drawing these hated enemies into a new day. And Jonah ran away from that call. Jesus, of course, is in a sense the antitype of that. He's actually going. He's going to the other side, to the other place. For the disciples, it's like, we told you so. You want to go to the other side? It's dark. Can you see what's kind of going down here? This was a dumbass idea. I'm sorry. Okay, well, they edit that out on the tape. I apologize. But it was, as far as they were concerned. And they wake Jesus and they say, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And so what they have in mind, surely, what they have in mind is, we've got to turn this boat around. This is a fool's mission. Don't you care? Sending us into harm's way. Calling us to, you know, like, why? Don't you care? And what they had in mind was, in fact, a turnaround. But Jesus wakes up and rebukes the wind and says to the sea, "Peace be still." And we read that the wind ceased, there was a dead calm. And he says, "Then why are you afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled, and this is an important verse, and they were filled with great awe, or with great dread, and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" Some commentators suggest, and in a sense, Doré captures this, that the disciples are in greater fear or greater consternation by what they see in Jesus than by what the threat of the storm represented. that this mission to the other side is one that will not be thwarted. And with truly sovereign cosmic authority, given the mythological overtones of what a storm we see represented, the fact that Jesus could speak to the storm that was opposed and resistant to this mission and commanded to be still elicited for the disciples the sense of, like, oh my God, who is this? And what are we about?
Is there a sense in here, they've been with him a certain amount of time and they've seen all these incredible healings and casting out of demons, all these miracles happening, and then all of a sudden they ask the questions like they've never seen him before.
Right.
You know, they've seen so much, and why does it surprise them that he extends it just a little bit farther?
Well, it's a key theme within Mark's gospel, especially in terms of the disciples who actually just don't get it. And they see all of these works, but they don't actually see through them to who it really is. And in fact, part of the majesty of Mark's gospel is that insight of who Jesus is will only be afforded at the conclusion of the gospel, when he dies on the cross. And as he dies, Mark 15:39, it's a centurion who says, truly, this was the Son of God. And it's the first time in all of Mark's gospel that a human person names him as the Son of God. The demons, the evil spirits do so, but it's the first time that a human person names him. And so the flow of Mark's gospel from Mark 1:1, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus, the Christ, the Son of God, that's in a sense a summary of the entire gospel, of this revelation of who Jesus is. And halfway through, when Peter says, you're the Christ, and in Mark's gospel, he doesn't go to say the Son of the living God. That's in Matthew's gospel. He's kind of giving the first half of the picture. But the full picture will only emerge in terms of the cross, in terms of the cost, the sacrifice of what it actually means to go to the other side. And the cross becomes that representation of that. So, I'd like us to in the time that we've got, in fact, I've got a couple of stories from the South African context. Let me push pause first. Any responses to this in terms of the image, the text, something of this? I was wanting us to maybe spend a bit more time saying, okay, what does it mean then? What does it mean then to be disciples of Jesus who calls us to go to the other side? And as we've been talking about the beloved community this week, as Asa has been challenging us, and the reality that this place is pretty lily white, apartheid South Africa would be proud. And I don't mean to say that in an offensive way, but it's reality. It's a reality. So what is the other side in terms of for a community like this? And the challenge, the uncomfortable challenge of what Christ says in terms of what he's about and where he's going and who he's calling to be with him. And as some of us are preparing to leave this place, to be going back to where are we going to, what are we hearing? What is being stirred here? What is the challenge? What is the hope? In terms of whether it's the racial stuff, whether it's the climate stuff, the creation stuff, whether it's sexuality stuff. Are there any connections that people are hearing? Yes, Asa.
So, Johnny's notes, and strikes me that I am getting in the boat and going literally across the lake to another side.
By being here.
Me. What do you...
Right.
Love it.
That I am literally getting in a boat and going across the lake, and holding for me is the other side. And this is Gentile territory for me. And so I'm sitting here reflecting on then what does that mean? And that going beyond verse 41, what happens on the other side?
Right.
What takes place on the other side for both the disciples and Jesus and for the Gerasenes?
Who are bound,
who are bound up in the cemetery.
And so thank you so much for sharing that. And so if I could just probe a little further. So as you get in the boat and you cross a lake and you come to the other side, where is Christ for you in that?
That's what part of what I'm reflecting on. The frustrating part of being a disciple in the middle of a storm with a sleeping Jesus is that Jesus is asleep. Right,
and at the wheel,
right? Yeah, or yeah, the rudder, right? So then, in other words, he's difficult to find because he's not where he's supposed to be, which is freaking out with us. So there's a searching that has to happen that I think is the wrestling for me coming up lake to Gentile territory to find Jesus.
But isn't there a sense of hope and maybe comfort that in the midst of the storm that feels so threatening, Jesus seems completely unintimidated. Like, and it's, you know, kicking in that second chaos tradition, it's like, it's all right. You know, it's like he can actually have a nap. There's a sense in which there is something bigger that's actually unfolding here. And so our frantic and chaotic murmurings and grumblings and protestations maybe need to be cast in that light. But thank you for sharing that. Yes, other connections.
I'm curious about the nonchalant guy. Maybe that's laid back. Maybe he's the one with good courage who doesn't know where they're going. But only that they're being led by Jesus.
Right. Of course, I mean, some would say, well, is that nonchalance? Or is it kind of, it may well be. And okay. Yes.
Perhaps well-meaning and apathetic. We have to be in that boat somewhere.
Right. Well, let's see how this is going to work out. here we go. All right. Any other? Yes, up top.
So I've gone back to verse 36, and oftentimes, at least from my Lutheran upbringing and understanding, it's God is the initiator. God is the initiator of all activity.
Right.
They took him. Huh. They drug him along into this story. They drug him along into their turmoil. They drug him along. Is what I'm kind of thinking. And then now he's in this with them and said, chill, guys.
Yeah.
Relax.
So the initiative has been Jesus. He says, let us go across. But then you're making the observation that they took him with them in the boat. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
Mine is with the same verse, but the other boats were with him. So think of who's with us, and you can't see them in a picture. I can't see who else is with me in this journey, but they're there.
Right. Thank you.
The Holy Spirit.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other comments? And yes.
Well, I'm really struck by what Asa just said, and that seems to me to be something of a teaching moment. This, to put this in, that we've been talking all week about we should be going to the other side, And all at once he says, well, I just did it. And
he's bringing his students next year.
And short,
so it's gotta be hope then.
And short of being a little uneasy about walking in the woods, he seems okay with this.
So I saw the bear today.
Yeah.
And the earthquake, yeah.
Well, it's also like something's happening here, eh?
To me, the lesson is, hey, if he can do it, we can do it.
And thank you for that comment. You know, we so often kind of identify ourselves in terms of, you know, the disciples and on this, and that's been the thrust of the reflection this morning. But can we see ourselves in terms of those on the other side in need of the evangel, the good news that would be coming of what the kingdom is seeking to be breaking in? So I'd like to close, and unfortunately the sound is being a little bit temperamental, but I'd like to close. We've got about just a few minutes left. And I want to play a quick clip coming out of the South African story from the days in the early 90s when there was the negotiations unfolding in terms of some kind of plan to move to the other side of what apartheid had been, to be moving to the other side of a post-apartheid South Africa. And two of the key negotiators in that process, for the ANC, the party of Nelson Mandela, a chap by the name of Cyril Ramaphosa, who is now the president of South Africa. And on the side of the nationalist government, the apartheid government, was a young Afrikaner by the name of Rolf Meyer. And this is a lovely clip of a kind of a connecting as they both kind of move, in a sense, to the other side of encountering each other. So I'm hoping that this is going to work. The sound isn't working through the system, and so we've got to do it like in a sort of physical way. And so I apologize. I sincerely hope that you're going to be able to hear.
I had gone fishing, and my host hadn't told me that Rolf Meyer was coming. He represented the apartheid government. I represented the African National Congress.
If I could put it in context, he was very much my enemy at that stage. And of course, he saw us in government as the enemies.
A helicopter lands as I'm holding my rod.
A mutual business friend of ours thought it could serve a good purpose if the two of us had a closer encounter.
And I get a shock. I said, why was I not told?
He himself at that stage was a long time already a fisherman. I've never become one.
And he wanted me to teach him how to fish. He was so clumsy with a fishing line and a hook. It got embedded in his finger.
The hook landed up in my ring finger, literally, and broke off.
And I said, look, this is what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to give you a stiff tot of whiskey. Just gulp it down, close your eyes, and I'll take this hook out.
Cyril said, okay, give me a set of pliers.
And I just took it out.
One twist of the set of pliers and pulled it out.
And he went white as a sheet. He's a white person, but he went white.
Somebody said, Cyril, you did it. And I said, Cyril, I trusted you to do it.
And that, in many ways, added a new dimension to our relationship.
I had the feeling I would like to know this man better. We came to understand each other, became friends, and then Cyril and I developed amongst ourselves a slogan that said, it's not a problem that we can't resolve. There was very little that could be thrown at us without us finding a solution and the right way forward.
Great story. And so, as we are into our last few moments, There's one further piece, like a montage of images that I've put together. Again, it comes out of the South African story, which talks a little bit about some of the juxtapositions of black and white, and maybe a vision of the hope of what emerges in terms of the pain as well as the joy of our story. And so as we've been looking at images this whole week in terms of as a way into the biblical text, I'd like us to close by looking at some images. The photography in this, most of it comes from my brother-in-law, in fact, or my sister's ex-partner, father of my niece, who is regarded in South Africa as what we would call a so-called coloured person, a person of mixed race, but this amazing photographer. And so there's just like a little beautiful nuance there in terms of his creative work. And the music that we'll be hearing is from a kind of a contemporary band that emerged at the end of the 80s in South Africa, which was one of the first sort of mainstream sort of pop bands that was truly multiracial within South Africa. And they're singing a song called Special Star, which of course speaks about what shines in the midst of the darkness. So we'll perhaps close with this.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. We'll call that a session for today. God bless you.